this week's edition of Debriefing the Law. I am Joel Oster.
I am Chris Marone.
I should say I am a healthy Joel Oster. Chris, it sounds like you're a little under the weather. Have you been doing a little bit too much partying out there in Phoenix area?
Final Four's coming to town. Baseball season starting. You know, it's just late nights for the Maroons. It's just killer, man. I'm not a spry young man anymore.
I know. I have family over, and they were up late last night. I'm like, dude, no, it's past 9 o'clock. This is past my bedtime, guys. Come on, I gotta go to bed. But that being said, thank you so much for getting up this early morning, despite your partying ways. Podcast brought to you by the Comedian of Law. We do CLEs that educate and entertain. And this class, Chris, is going to be one of the classes that we teach in our CLEs. Today we're going to discuss part two of the trial of Jesus, a very historical trial. It's timely because this is Easter, which kind of brings me into my first topic I wanted to discuss. Chris, are you one of those people that corrects someone, or do you find that somewhat unpleasant and so you avoid correcting someone who's making a blatant faux pas?
I always correct people, Joel. I'm that type of jerk. Okay. Like, it's ruining my marriage, let me tell you.
I don't know if we should get into too much of details there, but I think there might be an interesting story there somewhere. Yeah, but I did a conference a couple of years ago, and I was doing this conference, and I was going to be speaking to people and interacting with people. And this lady comes up to me and starts looking at my mouth. And then she is closer to my mouth. And I'm going, what's going on here? Why is this lady getting closer to my mouth? And finally she says, you got something between your teeth. Okay, I did. I actually had a big old something right there between my two middle teeth. And I actually was very appreciative of this lady pointing that out. I would not have wanted to go networking all evening trying to impress people with a big old piece of spinach or lettuce, whatever it was, between my two middle teeth. Chris, would you have done that? I'm not talking to me. I know you would have done that to me, but someone who you weren't necessarily best buds with.
Actually, you know what? Sorry. One, I don't eat lettuce or spinach, so that wouldn't have been a problem for me. But besides that point, I totally would. One of the things that my wife taught me early on is that if you're wearing lipstick and you have it on your teeth, to point that out to the person who has it on their teeth because they would appreciate it.
There you go.
And so I have made sure to do that whenever I see it. And it's just a quick little, hey, and it's usually done. See, it's never a production.
Wise words from your wife. Well, I say that because apparently don't have anyone like that in my life. Because last week I did a podcast and I did weekly updates on Easter. Easter was coming up, and I said, hey, this is Holy Monday. This is Holy Tuesday. And then no one told me, Joel, this isn't Easter week.
Look, it wasn't us. I wasn't there. I can't say I would have helped you, Joel. I would have helped a brother out. I would have definitely helped a brother out.
Finally, an old quizzing friend of mine texted me and said, Joel, I've been watching these updates, and you do realize that this isn't Holy Tuesday. You know, you're a week off. And I thought, why didn't anyone tell me this? I was doing updates every day. Today's Holy Monday. Today's Holy Tuesday. And I know I was an entire week off. So that being said, here's the public service announcement. Do correct someone, but do it in love, because we don't want to go on embarrassing ourselves. But apparently, Chris, this is Easter week.
It is. This is Holy Week.
All right, there we go. So we are going to talk about part two of the trial of Jesus. Hey, one more note before we jump into some of these legal stories. Peeps or no peeps?
Oh, man. Man, I'm a no peep guy. But like, not like a no peep, like peeps are disgusting, like you shouldn't eat peeps. I'm just not into it. Just not there for me.
Now, clearly you have Christian Easter, and then you have this horrific I don't want to bastardize. Idolatrous. Exactly. That's where the peeps come into the Easter story. Smash it with a hammer. Idolatry. That's the appropriate way. I saw some meme, but the appropriate way to eat memes is like someone picked up a trash can and dropped it in there. Maybe even dumped it in the toilet, whatever. That's the appropriate way to dispose of peeps. Do not put it in mm-hmm. your system. All right. Hey, before we jump into the trial of Jesus part two, there was something in the legal news this last week, so I thought we should mention it. Trump's situation there in New York. Now, I know some Trump followers think that, oh, Joel, this is kind of close to the trial of Jesus. They are that delusional, but I'm not one of those type of people. I am a conservative, but I am not that crazy. And so let's talk, though, a little bit about Trump's legal situation. So what's going on here? He had a civil lawsuit there in New York mm-hmm. where they alleged, the attorney general alleged that he filled out some mortgage application papers incorrectly. He misstated the value of some of his property. Now, Trump's legal position has been, this is not a crime. This is a victimless situation because he told the bank, by the way, this is not him asking me to lend him some money. He's asking another Fortune 500 company, a big company, to loan him money. They're going to do their due diligence. They were not taken advantage of, at least according to Trump, and I kind of buy that. The big banks, they're going to do their due diligence. They know who they're dealing with. And so Trump told them the value of his property, but they also said, you need to do your own appraisal if you're going to loan us this money. And the mm-hmm. banks responded with saying, okay, we're going to loan you this money. And then Trump paid back those loans in total. So this is not a situation where there was a victim, according to Trump. Nonetheless, the attorney general came in and said, I want to get Trump. Elect me attorney general, I'll find a way to go after Trump. And so she said, look, he misstated the value of his property when he sought these loan applications. So right here, you're thinking, what is the actual crime? Was there even a crime at all here? But nonetheless, it did go to trial, and the judge said there was fraud. So that's what the judge ruled. And so the consequence was $354 million fine.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris, that is that fine excessive? How will Trump? So one of the issues then was, for in order for Trump to appeal this case, as is normally the situation, you have to post bond of the civil judgment. In other words, if you're going to appeal any case, so when you're appealing a judgment, you got to post bond for that amount of money. Yep. So the thought there being, if you lose on appeal, now the other person at least can get paid the judgment. And so here mm-hmm. for Trump to post bond here, it was a $450 million bond. And then Trump mm-hmm. went back to the judge and said, look, I can't come up with $450 million. That's not how it works. No one has $450 million lying around in their bank accounts, right? If you are that kind of person with that kind of wealth, your money is invested. It's in stocks. It's in other, places. Mm-hmm. It's just not in your bank account down at Bank of America. It was interesting that the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, whose name escapes me right now, Mark Cuban, who is no friend of Donald Trump. He is a Democrat. Even he said, look, this is ridiculous. No one has that money just lying around. That's not how billionaires operate. You just don't put $450 mm-hmm. or $350 billion in your checking account. And so Trump went back to this judge and said, look, I need some kind of, reprieve from this. The judge said, sorry, Charlie, I'm not going to reduce this amount of requiring you to post this bond. You're going to have to do it, or else the attorney general is going to start seizing your assets. Chris, what is going on in New York? This is the banana republic. This is the worst justice. Kind of application absolute, of the law.
Absolute justice is going on in New York right now. Suck it up, Donald. It's your time to pay.
Right.
So chickens have come home to roost.
I cannot believe they're trying to seize his assets on what is basically a victimless crime. So my thought then went to the Eighth Amendment. So are you familiar with the Eighth Amendment, Chris? I know you went to law school. When I say the Eighth Amendment, what do you think of?
Excessive bonds, bails, any sort of excessive fines.
All right.
And cruel and unusual.
Most people would think cruel and unusual punishment, right? Capital punishment. Can you get your head lopped off if you commit a crime? That's what you usually think when it comes to the Eighth Amendment. The Eighth Amendment also says, here's what it says. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. And so, could Trump use the Eighth Amendment to say this $350 million penalty fine for this, what he calls a victimless crime or a victimless situation, is that an excessive fine? Well, I found one case, Chris, that kind of speaks to this. It's United States v. Bahakajan. I probably butchered it that. It is a 1998 Supreme Court case, and the Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional to confiscate $357,000 from a certain defendant who failed to report possession of over $10,000 while leaving the United States. So the crime was, hey, you failed to report $10,000 when you left the United States. Therefore, we're going to impose a $357,000 fine. Now, I don't want to get into the history of the specifics of the case. It's not that relevant for our purposes here. But the court laid out a standard. And the standard was, is the fine grossly disproportionate to the actual conduct? If so, it's going to be an excessive fine under the Eighth Amendment. Any thoughts on Trump's fine? Was it an excessive fine?
Not at all. Not even a little bit. Not even a tiny bit. Trump is reaping what he has sowed. The idea of a victimless crime is only purported by the guilty.
All right.
It's, I did it, but no one got hurt, so it's okay that I did it. I shouldn't be held to a standard because nobody got hurt. So it's okay. It's the prostitution argument, right? It's a victimless crime. Everybody wins in this situation. She wins, I win, everybody wins.
To be clear, you're talking about the kind of prostitution where the female is readily agreeing, willing to, not enable. Like a sex trafficking situation.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. It is the victimless crime argument has been used over and over and over again to justify the actions of a bad actor who feels morally superior to the law.
All right. But you see the difference, though.
Thanks.
You see the difference, though, between a crime where I actually hurt you, I broke your arm.
Oh, no, I see the difference between
$10 from you and the actual.
Right, there's a difference. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's a difference. The only problem is it's still a crime.
Right.
Like,
but
if you don't like it as a crime, go become president of the United States and get the Congress to change the criminal code. You know, back when you had control of the House and the Senate and the judiciary and the executive office. Look, I don't like it. I don't like the crime that's on the book. I think fines are imposed upon the poor as a way to stop them, because $175 million bond, which is what it was reduced to, is still pocket change to a billionaire, like you said. So it's not really hurting him at all unless he's not rich. And then it is going to hurt him. So the victimless crime angle is the guilty trying to appeal to the moral masses, saying, I'm a martyr. And at the end of the day, chickens are coming home to roost, Donald. You screwed yourself. You put yourself in the limelight.
I do think he did. I think as far as the court wanting to help him, sometimes that's even more important than the actual law at play. Does the court think that we have an innocent victim here who can't defend himself? I don't think Trump fits that situation. But on the other hand, I do think the court would be very interested in this argument of, we have a crime here where it appears to be a victimless crime. The bank knew what they were doing. In fact, I don't even think fraud was committed. I think the bank knew exactly what Donald's situation was, and I don't even think there was fraud. So the underlying issue here might be that Trump's his best chance at overturning the appeal was there just simply wasn't any fraud here. That being said,
that would be, no crime, then no penalty.
To the extent that there was some kind of crime here, that the banks, that he overstated the value, though I don't think the banks relied on that, but to the extent he did overstate the value of his properties and should be held liable to that, is a $350 million fine, which resulted in a $450 million bond. Was that clearly excessive under the Eighth Amendment? Is it is it grossly disproportionate to the actual offense? I think that's an issue the Supreme Court might want to take up.
I think that the $464 million bond is absolutely unconstitutional, because I don't think for a second that I should have to put up any money until a final adjudication has happened. And I've seen this on the micro level, right? Where if you get a speeding ticket, if you want to get in front of a judge and contest your speeding ticket, you have to pay the fine first. And the fine's like $500 here in Arizona. So I have to come up with $500 to defend my innocence. And then 9 to 11 weeks later, I get that $500 back.
Man, I agree with
$500 is a lot to a ton to a individual that's drive, you know, that's trying to figure out their life. $500 is a make or break situation. I think that any time that you are required to prepay a penalty before it is fully adjudicated, that's completely unconstitutional.
It makes no sense, especially if, let's just say the crime didn't even happen, or it was really wrong at the trial level. You have a really solid basis for an appeal. Now, again, I get what you're saying, but let's just say argumentatively that it was a valid criminal conviction. Okay.
Right.
That's one thing. But if there are huge mistakes of law and you have a valid basis for an appeal, it's not going to be a frivolous appeal. In order for you to make those arguments, you now have to pay the entire amount and then some if you're going to post bond. To me, that does not make a lot of sense, especially in Trump's situation, because to get a $450 billion bond,
million dollar bond.
What bond company out there even has the ability to write that, to do that transaction? They're not going to be on the hook for $450 million.
Yes, they are. The same way that you got free representation when Casey Anthony was in the news, these big law firms came in and did it for free. It is a PR stunt.
Right.
Hi, I'm Chris Marone, bail bondsman, and I'm Donald Trump's personal bondsman. You know how many Yahoos and Jamooks are going to use you now because of your connection to Donald Trump? All these people that are out here, you know, the dredges of Trump's base that are getting arrested all the time for, I don't know, moonshining. Like, they're gonna call up Chris Marone, bail bondsman, because I've got the Trump stamp of a Trump prints money. Whether you like the guy or not, he prints money. Anybody and everybody who's associated with Trump is getting rich real quick.
You are right.
Because the base is so, so dedicated and such worshiping at the feet of Trump that anybody who has Trump stamp of approval, going for it. I was at Barrett Jackson Car Show, and they had Trump's Ferrari. Trump was the owner of this Ferrari in the 80s.
All right.
And people were still selling it as Trump's Ferrari, and it went for a mint at auction.
Oh, he actually had some trading cards that went for a ton of money this
right.
last couple
the
of
The Trump
years.
Shoes.
You are
Who's
right.
buying the Trump shoes?
You are right that Trump prints the money. In fact, this last week, apparently his Truth of Social went public, and his net worth went up $3 billion, almost doubled his net worth. According to some estimates, he does know how to print the money. Last thing before we move on. I believe, again, I want to put this out there into the universe, because I think this actually is going to be a basis for appeal. I think Judge Engoron's refusal to reduce the bond amount is going to play into dooming his decision. I think that his decision not to reduce it was clearly wrong. It was clearly punitive. And it seemed to show he's acting more as a partisan hack than a true jurist, because clearly... Here's what I don't like. I don't like it when a judge renders a decision and takes such pride and ownership in that decision that they do not want the decision to be appealed. It's like, no, that the process is you should allow for it to be appealed. So I do not like the judge's refusal to reduce the bond, knowing that it was difficult for Trump to come up with the bond money. And I think we're going to see that come into a later decision saying, look, the fact that they... did not reduce this to allow Trump to appeal this, and the appeals court had to step in and do that. I think that's going to be used against Judge Engoron's motivations.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I think that it's just, you know, a double standard, but let's get to something fun like the trial of Jesus.
All right, the trial. Wait a second. The something fun like the
Absolutely.
trial.
Absolutely.
of Jesus.
Absolutely.
All right.
Look, man, you're a believer, right? Without this trial, there's no salvation. So yeah, was it a sham trial? Yeah. Was it crap? Yeah. But did we know it had to happen? Absolutely. So the same way that I love Judas as one of my favorite apostles, I think that the trial of Jesus is an absolutely great topic.
Wow. We have a lot to unpack. So let's get going down this road. This is part two of our two-part Trial of Jesus podcast. And I want to start off here by saying, Chris, religion has been in the news a lot lately. I don't know if you have been watching, but the interplay between religion and law has been in the law a lot, or been in the news a lot. A football coach doing the Tim Tebow. Is that allowed? Yep. Can a high school football coach do the Tim Tebow at the 50-yard line? We covered that in a previous podcast. Philadelphia passed a law on foster care that seemed to target the Catholic Church. Is that okay for a city to kind of target an entire church's religious beliefs? How about Maine? Maine passed a law on school vouchers that says that everyone can participate except for sectarian schools, religious schools. So religion and the law have been in the news a lot lately. Well, Chris, that kind of brings up this issue of the separation of church and state. Some people say there is a separation of church and state in the law, to which I scratch my head. But I kind of like when you hear some talking heads make fun of other people saying, oh, what? You don't think there's a separation of church and state in the law? What an idiot you are. Chris, I am a constitutional lawyer. I have no idea what the separation of church and state means. Do you have any idea? I know you are wiser than most lawyers out there. Do you realize that if you pull out your pocket constitution, it's not there?
Well, I mean, it's not there the same way that privacy is not there, but we still believe we have a right to privacy.
So it's a concept, but it's not an actual law.
Well, I mean, if you look at the First Amendment, right, Congress shall make no law abridging the use of religion, and
respecting
then you have an equal
the establishment.
Protection.
You know, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
Right. So if we can't prohibit the free exercise of religion, and deal with the establishment of religion, what the 1789 founders were communicating is that government should not have a place in religion.
Okay, so what does that mean, separation between the church and state? Because, Chris, I am going to suggest there's a lot of intermingling going on. Let me give you some examples
here.
Let's say a politician runs for office, and this politician believes that he should do everything to the glory of God, even his vocation. So he passes a law banning murder. He passes a law banning stealing because those are against his religious beliefs. And he also passes a law regarding abortion. Hold on a second. You said you can't legislate your morality on us, but it's okay in the first two instances and not the third. Okay.
Yes, because murder and stealing are generally accepted moral codes of both religious and non-religious people. I think we can get together, religious and non-religious people, and say, do you think murder is okay? I would venture that for the majority, they would say murder's not okay. You would have a small troll crowd that says, well, what about war? What about the death penalty? What about, you would get into the finer points. But I think as a whole, as society, we can agree that domestic violence, murder, rape, incest, all of those are bad things as a society, and they're not founded in a religious belief.
All right, next, I think they are founded in a religious belief, but I get your point that even people on both sides of the article or aisle. All right, how about this next one? A pastor preaches a sermon that's a little bit too much hell, fire, and brimstone. The sanctuary catches on fire. They call 911, and the 911 operator says, no, we looked up your address. It's a church. There is a wall separating church and state. We can't come to your church and help you out. Is that okay under our First Amendment?
All right. No, but here's the flip side to that. You have a Davis County clerk that says, I'm not going to issue gay marriage certificates because I don't agree with gay marriage.
Okay.
No, the law of the land is that you issue the marriage certificates because that's the law of the land. The same way with 911, the law of the land is that we all pay into communal taxes, which pay for firefighters and police, and they have a responsibility as government employees to respond to all emergency situations.
Okay.
And by not dispatching an emergency vehicle to a burning church is akin to denying someone their other constitutional rights, because we have a constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property. We also have constitutional rights to, as a homosexual couple, to get married.
Well, okay, so you, rights, so basically, yeah, there is, you can go to it, even if it's a church, to save a church, the state can go to save the church. What about this one?
Right.
What if a certain state passes a law requiring every young kid who is over the age of, or under the age of 16, to be in some kind of school, a public school system, private school system, something like that. But there's a religious group out there called the Amish. She says, no, at the age of 14, our kids have to be on the farm. Is there a conflict there? Is the state law is in conflict with this religious belief? How do you handle that situation? Well, last example I want to throw by you. Just say hypothetically, there is a global pandemic. I know it's kind of hard for you to wrap your mind around that, but let's just say back in history, there used to be global pandemics. And let's say the state requires you to get a shot in your arm for the betterment of the entire society. Well, you belong to a church, let's just say the Christian Scientist, that's opposed to all medical intervention. Can the government require you to violate your religious beliefs and receive that shot?
Nope.
All right. So, Chris, I'm trying to make my point here is that there is a lot of interplay between religion and the law. It's not, there's a lot of intermingling. You can't have this strict separation. So what does this concept of separation between church and state means? How much intermingling is allowed? How much is not allowed? Well, Chris, that's why I think this case, the trial of Jesus, helps to speak to why we have this concept in our law. So with that being said, are you ready to jump into the trial of Jesus?
Absolutely.
All right. Part one, we talked a little bit about the Sanhedrin law that was at play with the trial of Jesus. And so let's just jump right in now to the actual crime that took place. And so the crime that took place was the overturning of the money tables. Chris, do you think we have a understanding now about how serious of a crime that was for Jesus to walk through the temple courts during the week of Passover, the big celebration, overturning the money exchangers' tables? Do we have an appreciation of that being that serious of a crime?
I mean, it depends on where you're sitting, right? You could say that. I mean, you could akin to what Jesus did to a lot of different things that are going on in the world, depending on what your political spectrum is, right? Some people are going to compare what Jesus did to the Black Lives Matter movements of, you know, going through and destroying property within St. Louis or other places. Some people are going to make an analogy saying that the January 6th insurrection was akin to Jesus going through and cleaning out the temple of the money changers. People will find a way to compare that action of Christ to so many other actions because they want to justify in their own moral codes what they think is right. But I don't think for a second we have an understanding, even a minuscule understanding of the long game that Christ played in that moment.
Right, because when he walked through the temple, again, this was the most populated time. So this would have been like the Super Bowl week. I know you have been in town when the Super Bowl came to your town. Can you imagine?
We're in Final Four right now. Like, the Final Four is here. So
you have a ton of people in this area. And if you have someone walking through that area, causing a lot of commotion and disturbance, that's going to disturb the peace. That is a serious, serious ordeal. And back in Jesus' day, the Romans very much craved peace. They wanted to collect your taxes, and they wanted to secure the peace. And here you got the Passover time. Can you imagine what would happen during the Super Bowl week, during all those festivities, if there was some riot going on outside the Super Bowl stadium? Now, also
bad for business.
Imagine, if you will, again, this is going to require you to stretch your mind here. Imagine if Roger Goodell had unlimited power. Can you go there with me for a minute?
It's hard, but I'm there.
All right. So what do you think Roger Goodell would do if there was some riot outside of the stadium?
He would. I have so many answers to this question right now. Depends. Is it going to make him more money? Then he's going to do nothing. Is it going to cause some sort of bad headline and he's going to look like an idiot? He's going to throw down the entire force of the NFL and their affiliates to make sure he doesn't look stupid.
And I think as much power as Roger Goodell had, the Roman emperors had a lot more power, though it might be close. Yeah, they're not going to want a disturbance during the Holy Week, during the Passover week. Now, they didn't really care about the religious aspect of it. They wanted to maintain the peace. So when Jesus was walking through the temple courts, overturning the money exchangers' tables, that was sure to elicit a strong response from the crowd, and that was the crime that precipitated the eventual arrest of Jesus. And I guess when I was in Sunday school class and I heard about that story, in my mind, it never triggered that was the crime that led to his arrest. I don't know, in your history and traditions, did it dawn on you that that actually was the crime that led to his arrest?
One of the things that my wife and I have done for years and years and years has been teaching the youth classes on like what's really going on, like really likening the scriptures onto themselves and really looking at stuff. And I want to say it's like 3 or 4 years ago, Easter time, we stumbled across it. It's not a heavily taught doctrine in most Christian religions that this, because the underlying act isn't really important to the story of the mock trials and all that jazz. But it's good to know that that's what they hung their hat on.
Right. That was the pursuit. I mean, these were still legal officials. These were still prosecutors. These were lawyers, if you will, police officers. They had to have some crime to arrest Jesus on, even if it was a front for some other crime. Yeah. They still had been operating under some basis of why we should be arresting this person. And it was overturning the money exchangers' tables. That was the crime that precipitated this decision of finally enough is enough. We need to arrest this Jesus person. And so, Kirsten, this next part of the story also I find very fascinating, because I'm a history major, which again, I think I've said this before, is the most worthless degree a person can get. No one cares about your history degree when they are making hiring decisions. Maybe when they're making firing decisions, asking themselves why they hired you in the first place. But here's what I like about the story. Sometimes it's hard to view a culture and any events that happened in a different world. So here, let's just say they wanted to arrest this person named Jesus. They heard rumors that this person named Jesus was walking in the countryside, teaching people, maybe agitating people. He was a person of interest. But how would they know who this Jesus person was? I mean, I don't think at this point in time, Jesus had his YouTube channel up yet. I could be wrong on that. I don't imagine the passion play was a thing back before the passion story actually happened. So they couldn't have just used those statues of Jesus as a reference point. This was before the Wild Wild West. There wasn't even wanted posters that were hanging with a picture of Jesus. How would they know who the person was? Did you ever think about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, he was gaining a lot of notoriety throughout the four Gospels, the main ones that we hearken back to, right? They talk about the life of Christ and how he was teaching in the temple at a very young age. He was performing miracles. The masses were coming and see him. So it was a very much like, did they have a digital copy of Jesus's passport? Not so much.
No.
But the word of mouth about Jesus and his arrival on Palm Sunday into Jerusalem, like coming back, like masses of crowds were welcoming this random dude on the back of a donkey. People were noticing, and he was, you know, he was becoming very, very well known as a threatening figure to the local, you know, Sanhedrin and Pharisees. And so they may not have like been able to describe him as a 6 foot tall, you know, bearded Arab Jew, blah 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 blah.
Right.
But people knew, and in the fanfare around Jesus, rightfully so, wherever he went, people flocked and fled to him and dropped what they were doing. So someone who commanded that much power was on the front page of everybody's book.
But that's my point. There were no books. There were no pictures. There were no videos. Right. So they heard rumors of this person. They knew that he was out there. He was amazing people as a young child. You know, they heard about him in the Judea area. He really only came to Jerusalem a couple of times. And so now he comes into Jerusalem. Oh, we heard about this person. Did you see him? What did he look like? As you said, well, he had, I think, long hair. He was the only white guy in the Middle East. Of course, they didn't say that. That would have been probably. I know the guy you're talking about. You know what I'm saying? Well, it would have been hard to actually pinpoint that's the person we need to arrest and not one of his other stand-ins trying to protect Jesus from a wrongful arrest. This was a tough issue. How do you identify the right person to arrest?
Well, he's the guy flipping tables in the temple.
So
like that there it is.
That's where we bring in the person of Judas. You already referenced Judas earlier in this podcast. I want to dig into what you said a little bit because you definitely perked my interest. But I know everyone knows who Judas was. Why do I know this? Chris, no one names their kid Judas. Do you know anyone with a name Judas?
Same way I don't know any Adolfs.
Exactly. I think these are the two names that are off limits for all future parents when they come to naming their kids. You can name your kid a direction like Northwest. You can name your kids a symbol. You can't name them Judas. We all know the story of Judas. But that's why you needed a Judas, someone who could identify Jesus.
Absolutely.
So go on.
Gosh, so I have a rough theory about Judas, and it's not really endorsed by anybody but Chris Marone, and it takes a leap of faith to get there. And the fact of the matter is if you believe in the Christ story, and I'm not saying all of our listeners do, so I'm not going to assume that everybody is a believer, but if you believe in the Christ story, which I fully endorse and believe to be true, that Christ knew who Judas was and what Judas would do. Okay. He knew from the beginning. He knew. Christ knew, and we know now, that there had to be a Judas. There had to be someone to do what you just say, to name Jesus, to point him out in a crowd and say, that's your guy right there, 2:00, long-haired white guy.
Right.
That's who you're looking for, right? So I have to believe on some level, because often the apostles in the scriptures, when they were visited by Jesus or when they counseled with him, they were given, you know, very godly information. They were provided, you know, prophecies and scriptures. I mean, you could talk about how Jesus told Peter that he would deny him 3 times before the night would be over. He also took, you know, Peter, James, and John up to the Mount of Trans and was able to ordain them to be the leaders of the church once Jesus left. Things to that effect. We don't read about Judas because everybody feels that he's a traitor. And I have no biblical proof and I have no historical proof to this, but the story never really stuck with me. I think at some point Judas knew that he was going to have to betray Jesus. And he probably wrestled with it and came to Jesus with his, like all the apostles did, to counsel with him to find out what he needed to do. And I think in that moment, Jesus let him know. And that Judas is essential to the salvation story. Without Judas, the Roman guards would never have found Jesus, which would not have led to the cross, which would not have led to our salvation.
That is interesting. You mentioned that. It's interesting you mentioned that the role of Judas was essential. Again, it kind of speaks to my historical point, which is you had to have someone identify who the actual real Jesus was. Because again, when I grew up listening to the story, I kind of thought, why did you even need Judas? I mean, they knew who he was. They saw him on TV on the evening news. They knew to just go arrest Jesus. You didn't need Judas to identify him.
Right.
You knew who he was. And then it dawned on me, well, they wouldn't necessarily know who he was. They might have an idea. But to actually get the right person at the right time, they needed someone to betray him. And so enter Judas. Now, there is a scripture whenever anyone asks me, Joel, what is your favorite memory verse? I always respond with Acts 1:18. Are you familiar with Acts 1:18?
Not Not offhand.
I memorize it for some
5
reason.
5 a.m.
And so I always repeat it and quote it word for word to people when they say they want some kind of positive words to live by. This is Acts 1:18. With the reward he got for his wickedness, Judas bought a field. There he fell headlong. His body burst open and all his intestines spilled out. Chris, put that up on your wall somewhere. Those are words to live by. But yeah, he was so overtaken by his grief that he committed suicide. And I think it is an interesting theological question. Is Judas in heaven? I have read stories of both ways, and I kind of think God's grace is sufficient. And does it cover that? Again, I'm not going to talk or make any conclusive statements when it comes to theology. It's an interesting thing to debate.
No, absolutely. Because again, look, if Judas, and this proves my, at least I think it proves my point, if Judas really was this garbage individual that hated Christ and that thought he was a fake and a fraud and just a con man, why would he have killed himself? Why would he have been so overcome with guilt?
Exactly. He was overcome with guilt, according to Acts 1:18.
He would have taken his money and gone.
Right.
He would have taken his money and he would have lived a really good life.
So somehow
he knew. Because nobody would have known who Judas was. Yeah.
Somehow he knew. He did what he did for a theological purpose, and he was overtaken with grief because of his role in it. Other people would take another conclusion, say, no, he acted so extremely wrong and horribly. He betrayed, you know, Jesus. But then again, if we know the story of, well, there had to be someone who betrayed Jesus. Right. Hey, again, interesting theology, great for debate. I'm not going to take a point on it, but I definitely love the debate. All right, so that's what happened. Judas then betrayed Jesus with a kiss. Apparently, that's, I don't know why it had to be a kiss, but whatever. That's how you identified people back then. Why couldn't it just be a tap on the shoulder, a point with a finger? I don't know. Kiss makes a better story.
I don't think he made out with him. Like, the greeting back then was that you would hug somebody and kiss them on the cheek. That was a Jewish greeting. They still do it today. I think it was more of like the hug in and you do the kiss on each side of the cheek. Like, come on.
Have you ever had an interaction with someone who has that culture of they kiss you on the cheek? I don't like it. I'm from the Midwest. We don't. But how do you go with it? You're going to mess up and get the wrong cheek and touch lips. I mean, I don't know. Just, you know, bro, you know what?
Dude, they come in and I automatically get the turn, right? I see them coming in and they get the turn.
No,
you're going in. Okay.
No, you know what? You get the fist bump from me. Here you go. We're going to meet each other with a fist bump. All right, well, let's move on here with our story. What happened next after Jesus was arrested? He was then taken before Caiaphas and the Jewish Sanhedrin. We talked a little bit about the Sanhedrin during our last podcast. They, 200 years after this, they codified some of their rules, but this was the Jewish legal court system. Caiaphas would have been the high priest. He would have also been the chief judge of their legal system. And now Jesus was brought before Caiaphas. Now, was what we're about to talk about, his hearing in front of Caiaphas and in front of the Sanhedrin, was this actually a trial or was it something else? Maybe akin to a preliminary hearing where the Jewish authorities were trying to find out what they had on this Jesus person. So that being said, let me just throw a couple of things out there. Under the Sanhedrin rules as they existed 200 years after this in written form, it would have been illegal to have this kind of trial at night. It also would have been illegal or against procedures to have a trial during Holy Week. So both of those things indicate this maybe was not a full-blown trial, or it was a inappropriate trial, either or. Do you have a take on whether or not this was an actual trial or some kind of preliminary hearing where they're trying to gather their facts to bring their case in front of Pilate, or does this not make a difference?
I think it doesn't make a difference because at this point it was a power grab. It wasn't I think that Pontius was trying to usher this out as quickly as possible because the multitude was in support of Christ. I mean, the people loved it. He was clearly a man of
the
people.
No, we haven't gotten to Pilate yet. We're still now in front of Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin.
My bad. Yeah. So they are trying, I think, to head it off at the pass, that if people started to get together, it was going to be a public outcry to release Christ, because people loved him and they've heard of his miracles and they want the miracles. And it was, they were trying to push this through super quickly, so that way it could get done and over with, and they could hopefully get this guy out of here and go back to business as usual.
Flavius Josephus, who was not a Christian, he was a Jewish historian writing about 90 AD, so just a few years after this situation, he wrote that that this person named Jesus, the Christ, was crucified at the hands of Pontius Pilate in the Roman system, but Pilate was urged to do so by our noblest citizens. He's talking about the Jewish leaders. So Flavius Josephus was saying that it started in the Jewish legal system, and then the Jewish legal system urged the Roman, Pilate to then crucify Jesus. So it was a two-tiered nature. It started in the Jewish legal system, but as we know here, and you just alluded to, it's going to end in the Roman legal system. All right, but first, so it's before the Sanhedrin. What was the actual charge? Well, according to all four gospel accounts, and the account of Peter, which that's an interesting thing. Have you ever read the Gospel of Peter? It's not in the actual gospel. It hasn't been canonized as part of the scriptures, but it was discovered and it was written. And so at least it pretends to be an account of the story of Jesus written from the apostle Peter. But again, it's not accepted into the canon. All right. Well, nonetheless, they all said it was blasphemy. So in all four different gospel accounts, the question was posed by Caiaphas, who are you? And basically he says, I am the king of the Jews. I am the Messiah. Yeah. What you say is true. You wouldn't believe me if I told you. Those kind of responses and statements. And so basically the Sanhedrin said, this is all the proof we need. You have committed blasphemy, which was a violation of Jewish law. And as we learned during part one, that was worthy of stoning. So right here, if this were a fair trial under the Jewish system, they could have stoned Jesus. And we went through the actual procedures for how you stoned a person. But Chris, they did not do that. Do you have any take or thought as to why they did not want to stone Jesus? They wanted instead crucifixion. They wanted to go to the Roman court system. Why go to Pilate when they already had a blasphemy conviction that could result in stoning?
Mainly so that way they had political insulation.
Okay, right? What do you
they
mean?
They didn't want to be, again, Jesus, super popular. They did not want to be the one to put Jesus to death. They wanted to keep control of their local, because at this point, the Jewish leaders were the local leaders, not the Roman leaders, which were already seen by some as just a ruling overlord body. And the Romans really didn't care about local issues. They wanted more to just make sure the money kept flowing up and down the roads and Roman citizens were protected, since not everybody could be a Roman citizen. So by punting it to the Romans, the local leaders were able, or were attempting to insulate themselves from any sort of local backlash. Like, hey, yeah, we did, but we kicked it over to the Romans because they're really the decision makers here on who lives and who dies. And, we didn't want to stone Jesus, or we didn't want to crucify him. The Romans did.
Interesting.
And so we're going to put them on them.
So you mentioned a couple of things that I want to point out. One was they wanted political cover. We see that today in our political world. And apparently it was alive and well back in Jesus' day. The Jewish leaders did not want to take responsibility for killing this very popular Jewish person. They would much prefer the Romans actually did that. And so they went to Pilate to bring their charges, hoping to get some kind of Roman conviction. So one, you got political cover. Two, you also had the thought they wanted crucifixion as a result. And so under Jewish law, they could not crucify someone. But under Roman law, they could crucify someone. Earlier today, I said this podcast brought to you by the Eighth Amendment. And so we already talked about the Eighth Amendment earlier when it came to, was Trump's fine, was that excessive under the Eighth Amendment? Well, the Eighth Amendment also bans cruel and unusual punishment. Well, crucifixion, I think it's fair to say it was cruel and unusual punishment. And so under the Roman law, Romans wouldn't even allow for their own citizens to be crucified. It was only available as a death sentence for non-Roman individuals. So you have that. Then also 200 years after this point, even the Romans banned crucifixion altogether. So it was a very much a barbaric way to pursue capital punishment sentences. So how did it work? You actually hung a person from a tree, from a cross, and allowed for the weight of their own body to kill that person. So number one, this is not quick. This would be very, very long. It could be days, right? You are going to hang up there, and eventually your body's systems would collapse on itself, and you would suffocate. That's why you can imagine a lot of heaving to kind of catch your breath as your lungs are collapsing, the different body is just collapsing on itself, and then eventually you die of suffocation on the cross. Very barbaric. Wow. Again, it was outlawed at this time against Jewish citizens, and it was outlawed entirely about 200 years later. And so if what the Sanhedrin wanted was crucifixion for Jesus, they had to go to Pilate. Now, Chris, it's important to note, Pilate was not this wise, prudent governor.
No, not at all.
First of all, he was kind of sent to the outskirts. If you were looking at a map at the Roman Empire, this is clear on the far right of the map. So I'm going to guess the far eastern part of the Roman Empire. And so he probably was not one of the better governors. That's why he was sent way out there, out east. And he also was considered quite brutal. He actually, according to Tacitus, a Roman historian, actually delivered a couple of capital punishment sentences without even a trial. Just, I don't like this person. Let's crucify him and get rid of him. He was that brutal of a governor. And so I think when they went before Pilate, they had a pretty good idea what the outcome was going to be. Nonetheless, and indeed, that's what they got, though I know the biblical story offers a little bit more information as to the workings of Pilate from a historical standpoint. Again, what we do know is Pilate then agreed crucifixion was what's going to be the remedy or the sentence for Jesus. Any thoughts on this trial?
I mean, trial in quotation marks. Again, like it's tough from a lawyer's perspective, right? It's an absolute sham. Like it's no evidence. It's political cover. It's absolutely ridiculous. From a religious perspective, absolutely needed and 100% in line with the Father's plan to make sure that all of us can return to him. So I think Joel, you and I find both a lot of the time that sometimes our religious beliefs are at odds with how the legal system works. And so what are we doing for the benefit here? I think in the idea of Jesus, the benefit is the long game, right? Is salvation of humanity. Whereas some of the other cases we talk about, capital punishment, abortion, stuff like that, that's, you know, is that for the salvation of humanity? I can't make that same. I have 2,500 years of history to look back at the trial of Jesus and say, yeah, that's what it was for. We don't have that sort of hindsight with, you know, Dobbs.
Well, I do want to get to the theological part, and I like the aspect of it because, again, this is our podcast. We can do whatever we want. But before that's we right. get there, from a legal perspective, I think this trial, when you say sham, I assume what you're referring to is the fact that due process was not afforded. There was not given a notice. Mm-hmm. They were violating a lot of the rules.
Right.
And it was almost a predetermined outcome. You should not be prosecuting someone with an idea of this is just a sham. We want to get to the conviction right away. That being said, I do think you see some reasons here for this trial, some reasons why we have this concept of a separation between the church and state. I think you can see the dangers of joining the penal arm of the state with the theological part of society, right? When you give your Sunday school teacher the ability of one of the full range of consequences and deterrence and retribution to at her disposal when you don't memorize your Bible verses for that week, that's not a good situation. And historically, you can see that as well. And here, you don't want the part that's responsible for enforcing theological doctrine having the ability to actually put you to death. Again, that's not a good combination. Historically, it's been a horrible combination. And in this trial, I think you see that played out live and well. So, Chris, isn't it kind of difficult for us as a legal mind, a legal people, to look at this story and say, this is a horrible trial, But yet on the theological side, this was needed because now Jesus was offered as the sacrifice for the atonement of sins for all time. So isn't it kind of hard to see this as a horrible thing, but also a good thing at the same time?
I think, like, theologically, it's an amazing thing. Like, I think that it's my salvation. It's my opinion. It's my belief. My only issue with that is people have been using this trial as an excuse to justify whatever actions they deem, right? You get these, you know, yahoos, for lack of a better term, that are like comparing themselves to the trial of Jesus, and it's clearly you've missed the boat. Like clearly you've read, like, you've cherry-picked your Bible verses, because the whole point of the trial of Jesus and the life of Jesus was that he was the only one that could have done all these things, theologically speaking. He is the only begotten. He is the only person who was ever chosen to do this. So the fact that you think you're Jesus, bro, slow down, because you're not. And so theologically, the trial is great. I love it because we're hastening the work of salvation. Legally, now there's a lot of holes in it.
I don't want to engage in blasphemy because, again, that's mm-hmm. a bad thing, I've been told. And so I'm going to tread lightly in what I'm about to say, because I don't think it's right to compare the different parts of the Easter story, say which is more important than the another mm-hmm. part of the Easter story. That being said, I do think the fact that Jesus, you know, God incarnate, would be willing to subject himself to the legal system is an amazing part of the Easter story. Now we get the resurrection and all that, and that's amazing. But then again, he's also God, so is that really that? I want to tread lightly here because I don't want to downplay anything as part of the Easter story. It's all amazing. But that being said, subjecting himself to our legal system, I don't want to subject myself to the legal system, and I've done a lot of bad things. But here we got God incarnate subjecting himself to the legal system so he could be the atonement for sins, you know, once and for all time. That is an amazing, amazing story. All right, so go eat your Peeps, go eat your Reese's peanut butter eggs, your whatever other kind of Cadbury eggs. I hate to say this, but in my car, I actually have both. I have a 5-pack of Cadbury eggs and a 6-pack of Reese's peanut butter eggs. I have both because you know what?
They're delicious.
You celebrate Easter any way you can. All right. Hey, you know what? That is the trial of Jesus, an amazing story. So before we go here, we have a little bit of time to cover a little bit of sports. And so it's time for our courtroom quarterback segment. All right, Chris, we are not going to talk about my KU Jayhawks in basketball. I don't know what happened this year. I know we had great plans. I was going to come to Arizona and watch them play in the Final Four. Maybe that was the jinx that doomed them in. But our head coach, Bill Self, said about a month ago he gave up on the season and started looking forward to next year. That's really a bad thing for your head coach to say. So we're just going to ignore all of that. I want to focus here on Shohei Ohtani. He is in a lot of legal trouble. And since this is a legal podcast, first and foremost, let's jump right in. What is your take on Shohei Ohtani's gambling issue? Explain what's going on.
So Shohei, great baseball player, probably, and we've had the discussion, he's arguably on track to be one of the greatest baseball players of all time.
Absolutely.
And I am here for this. Shohei has an interpreter that's been a high school buddy of his. Now, Joel, you and I have come up and been incredibly successful, so I know we both have this understanding of high school buddies who are trying to be the feeder fish around the shark's mouth and catch whatever scraps we throw at them. So that's where this guy is. Not allegedly, $4.5 million was transferred out of Shohei Ohtani's business account by his, Shohei Ohtani's bank account by his former, now, interpreter. Where did that $4.5 million go? That is the actual $700 million question. Because if it went to gambling, which is the allegations at the moment, Shohei's done in baseball.
Well, hold on. Not necessarily. It's going to be based upon Shohei Ohtani's knowledge. Was he duped? What did he really know what was going on? Or did he give this interpreter a little bit too much access and too much trust because of their background into his financial affairs? Isn't there a little bit of wiggle room for Ohtani to being duped here?
Yes and no. If you go on past precedent, the answer is no. If you want to create some new precedent because the face and $700 million investment boy of the MLB, the international MLB, right? Because, yeah, the Dodgers may have sunk $700 million into him, but Shohei Ohtani is now his brand is worth over $1 billion for MLB.
Wow, Chris.
We played our first opening series in Korea. We're going international with the Yankees. Just played like the Mexico City Diablos in an exhibition game. Like baseball, not unlike any other sports, but baseball more than anything else is an international sport. People play it. I know it's America's pastime, but people play it all over the world. You have the World Baseball Classic. You had baseball in the Olympics for a period of time. It is a truly international sport. So now that we have this international face in Shohei Ohtani, which don't get me wrong, I really like Shohei Ohtani, even though he wears Dodger blue.
I think you just stumbled on what's going to happen here. It didn't dawn on me before you started talking, but now I think it's crystal clear. You got to understand the context here. Baseball, let's just go back 30 years, was huge in America. It was America's pastime. No one would say baseball is America's pastime right now. And so they're trying to get a foothold and trying to reverse this negative slide. And so they want to go international, like soccer. Right. Baseball is an international sport. It is a sport that can be played clear across the globe. And now you got an international star. Will baseball, knowing how much room is market share is lost to the NFL, and knowing that they got probably the biggest star ever, even bigger than Babe Ruth, because he is international. Babe Ruth was just national.
Right.
Are they really going to shut him down? Chris, the answer has to be no. Then find out the reason why they won't shut him down.
What they straight up need to do, and look, we talked about this in the pre-show notes. This story of Shohei Ohtani breaking, you know, the breaking story was, you know, Shohei Ohtani involved in a $4.5 million gambling scheme. If you looked at any of the websites that story broke on, what were all the ads on the right and left of that story? Caesar's Playbook,
right?
FanDuel, MGM Bets, whatever one Kevin Hart does, the Jamie Foxx, the ESPN bet. So you know, betting on sports is a multi-billion-dollar industry and always has been, but it's really entered into the mainstream now with the internet and a lot of these, you know, I'm waiting for the day that MLB bet shows up or NFL They want their cut of the gambling cash.
Oh, it's huge.
And you can do it through an app now.
And Chris, here's so also,
they need to change the rules. They need to change the rules around sports betting, and then they need to let Pete Rose in the Hall of Fame. That's where it comes back down to.
So before we go there, which I do agree, Pete Rose absolutely belongs in the Hall of Fame. But before we go there, I do think we also need to realize that Ohtani is not going to be kicked out of baseball. We know that, right? Let's say Major League Baseball says, we want to take the high road here. We're going to kick him out. We can't allow this. We don't buy his story. We're going to kick him out. He's going to go to Japan. He is already the biggest baseball star in the world. Yeah. He proved he's going to dominate the Major League Baseball scene. Now he's going to go to Japan, and Japan's baseball scene is now going to be elevated above Major League Baseball. That can't happen. Major League Baseball will not let that happen. So here, I think, is an example. The outcome has already been determined. They will not kick Ohtani out of baseball. Now, how will they get to that result? What stories get swept under the rug? And if there's a criminal investigation, can Major League Baseball control what stories get swept under the rug? Chris, this is going to be a fascinating story.
Right. But I think that Ohtani is insulated enough to where there's not going to be criminal proceedings. I don't think, and maybe his interpreter will take the fall. He will fall on the sword, which is quite the Japanese thing to do. And so Ohtani, I think, is free from criminal drama. I think that I really do think, and I really do actually hope that, and I'm going back to Pete Rose here, that MLB sees the error of their ways when it comes to betting on yourself, right? If bet, like what Pete Rose did, bet on his team to win, not to beat the spread, not to do anything else, straight up and down win, that betting on yourself is not incentive to change the outcome of a game.
That's consistent with the outcome of the game. But do you really know, right, when you're betting on yourself as compared to betting the other way? If you allow players
you have to register
bet on your team, okay, register your bet. Right. Okay.
Yeah, you could register your bet.
Why not so then?
Because people think gambling is a victimless crime.
I tell you what, I think what you
gambling
said is
illegal.
What you just said is radical, but I think it's actually right on. I think that Major League Baseball should seriously consider allowing players to bet on their own teams. It doesn't change their motivation. They already are betting on themselves career-wise or wanting to play with this team. That makes total sense to let them bet. Maybe they're doing it to help them save themselves. I don't know, but at least it makes sense.
If you're making the league, so you're on the 53-man roster for baseball or the 64-man roster for baseball, right? Like, you're making the league minimum of 118. Bet on yourself.
You know,
straight up. I mean, you know the team, like the Cincinnati Reds, nobody's going to bet on them to win. You know, right now, all these, the small market, the Oakland A's, I mean, you have a better chance of you know.
Okay, that would be hilarious. That's the reason why they won't let players bet on themselves, because that would mean the Royals and the Oakland players couldn't actually bet on games. A very fascinating take on that situation. All right, well, that was just starting this last week. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to cover on that situation that involves the intersection between law and sports, which is our sweet spot. Hey, Chris.
Love it.
We're out of time here. Have a great week, a happy Easter, and see you next week.
See you next week, Joel.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a complete and utter mess. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. Brooke Boland for our marketing efforts, and Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.